Okay, so today is Thursday, February 6th. We are going to start on page 35 in your course pack. And we're going to be talking about the cardiovascular system. That's the majority of what test number two covers. You may have noticed on that previous slide that the lymphatic system, but that is a 30-minute conversation. So where you want to put your study efforts is in chapter 17 and 18 with heart and blood vessels. So we're going to take this in a two-prong approach. We're going to start and cover the heart information first, and then we'll cover the blood vessel information second. So I know you've had heart anatomy. We'll go back through that here in lecture, and then we're going to get into the physiology stuff probably on Tuesday. All right, so in terms of the cardiovascular system, there's two parts. We have the heart, which is pumping the blood, and then we have the blood vessels, which transport that blood. All right, so in terms of size, shape, and orientation, the heart is approximately the size of a human fist. You know, when you look at those cow and sheep hearts in lab, some of those are huge. You know, I mean, that's way bigger than would fit in one of our bodies. So, you know, about fist size is approximately human size. The heart is more or less in the center of your chest, although you're going to feel the heart pumping on the left side of your chest. And that's because the ventricles are oriented down towards your left hip. Technically, it's about a half inch sitting toward the left, but you know, nonetheless, it's more or less center of your chest cavity. The right shoulder is how the blood vessels on top of your heart are oriented. You can see them sticking up right here. Okay, so they're oriented more or less toward your right shoulder, and those pumping ventricles are angled down toward your left hip. Now, what was the name of that chest cavity? Thoracic, right. And inside your thoracic cavity is a nice little spot, a snug area for your heart to sit. And what's that little spot called? Mediastinum. Good. And easy to remember because media sounds like medial or middle. It is, in fact, middle of your chest. And stinum sounds like sternum, which is what we're sitting underneath, that sternum bone. All right. So you can see the heart here situated very close to your two lungs. It does rest here on top of that diaphragm, and what we can't see from this picture, but we can from this one, is how the vertebrae, and we've got, of course, trachea and esophagus traveling down the back side of the heart. They're situated right there. So no wonder people feel like they've got heartburn when they've got GERD or gastroesophageal reflux. All of that stuff is in the similar area, and the nerve information that goes to our brain, we oftentimes can't distinguish, you know, just acid reflux from actual heart issues. All right, so here's another view. You can actually see from the top-down view, you've got all these blood vessels emerging from the top. You've got the esophagus and trachea coming through here, and then back here is that vertebrae. So it's a very tightly packed cavity with a lot going on. So since we have a lot of tightly packed organs here in the thoracic cavity, let's talk about a way to avoid them from frictioning and rubbing past one another. Back in Bio210, you probably talked about these membranes that surround our organs. Those membranes were what type?
Serous.
Good. And unlike other membranes, these are moist, and they're also two layers, double layers. We have two layers. The innermost layer is called the what layer? Visceral layer. And the outermost layer? Parietal. Good. So in the picture down here, you can actually see the innermost layer that covers the heart would be your visceral layer. And this number two would be your outermost layer. That outermost layer is the outside of the two. Now, both of those layers of the serous membrane are secreting a type of fluid. What's that fluid? It is serous fluid. Good. And the function of that fluid? Yeah, cushioning, reducing friction, lubricating. Because what potentially could the heart rub up against?
The lungs.
The lungs, right. So this watery cushion around the outside of the heart and the lungs prevents frictioning as the heart beats and the lungs inflate and deflate. All right, So what is the specific name of this particular serous membrane?
Pericardium.
Good. So going back to this picture, number one would be our visceral pericardium. And number two would be what?
Parietal
pericardium. Good. Okay. So in terms of serous membranes, the innermost is your visceral pericardium. Your outermost is your parietal pericardium. You'll notice on your sheet there, under serous fluid, a term called the cardiac tamponade problem that we're going to talk about. All right, so you can inflame that pericardial sac. And if you think back to Bio-210, inflammation typically results in four issues. What are they?
Swelling.
Redness. Redness, heat, and pain. So the real problem here is the swelling, because if you have that pericardium swell, it's like a water balloon that takes on water. So we can accumulate excess serous fluid between those two layers. This is what you got. This is a pericardial sac that has excess fluid in between the visceral and the pericardial layers. That sac is actually going to cause swelling that expands around the outside of the heart, and it puts pressure downward on the heart, so it squeezes the heart. So unfortunately, this can make a person feel like they're having a heart attack. It's going to create heart pain because of the squeeze on the heart. Now, one solution for this is to extract or syringe off that excess fluid. You can see in the picture over here on the right, a needle is inserted around that pericardial cavity. We don't want to go through the heart wall itself, but we want to hit only that pericardial sac and extract off that fluid. So this problem, cardiac tamponade, results from having excess fluid in the pericardial cavity. That is the space between the visceral and that pericardial membrane. I tell you, this is what's confusing about the chapter. The name for this problem, cardiac tamponade, is also called heart plug. It's also called cardiac or pericardial effusion. However you float the name, it's too much fluid, too much serous fluid around the outside of the heart. I'll tell you an easy way to remember this, though. Tampons. Tampons, right? They soak up fluid. And so cardiac tamponade, you want to get rid of that excess fluid. So that you won't forget now what cardiac tamponade is. So people who have a history of smoking may end up with pericarditis. If you happen to have an infection, you know, infections travel. They can start one place and end up somewhere else. Infections that land in your heart can also cause pericarditis. We may see cancer causing it. Even cardiac surgery can inflame the heart and cause it to swell on the outside. And then, of course, heart attack can cause it as well. So anything that leads to inflammation around the heart can cause this excess fluid accumulation. All right. Let me take you back a picture or two. I just mentioned that sometimes in this chapter you're going to find more than one name for an item, and that is the case for that visceral pericardium. On your worksheet, you'll want to notice an alternate name for visceral pericardium. What's it also called?
Epicardium.
Epicardium, right. So now let me take you to the bottom of the page where it says three walls of the heart. Okay, so from the outside, let's see, we've got a fibrous tough covering. It's out here called the fibrous pericardium. We didn't really talk about that one yet. But you'll notice if you peel it back, it's going to bring with it your parietal layer of that serous membrane. Okay? So the best way for me to describe that outermost portion is to describe to you double-sided gift wrap or newspaper. You've got writing on both sides, right? And if you look at one side, you can't really separate it from the other side. They're together. Well, that's what happens here with this outermost covering. We haven't yet talked about the fibrous pericardium, but it is a tough outer covering around the heart. And anchored to it is this parietal layer of the serous membrane, so we can just simply call it parietal pericardium. Okay, right through there. So I can't really peel back the fibrous pericardium without also bringing along with it parietal, okay? This dark piece right through here is actually just a space. They call it pericardial space or cavity. And what should be housed in that space? Fluid, yeah, so that's where your pericardial fluid, that's your serous fluid that's found between those parietal and visceral layers. Now, if I keep coming on deep in toward the heart, I now encounter another membrane, this one right here, and you'll notice this one is called my visceral layer, or the epicardium. And you'll notice that this layer, being the innermost layer, is directly anchored to the heart muscle wall. And so, if you've ever bought a package that has some shrink wrap that you can't just peel off with your fingernails, you know, sometimes you have to get a pair of scissors to cut off shrink wrap. That is your visceral layer. It is so tightly anchored to the underlying muscle tissue that you can't really separate the visceral layer from the heart itself. Okay, so let's go through this again. The outermost layer is a tough covering. It's fibrous pericardium. It has a serous membrane anchored to it. What's the name of that serous membrane? Yeah, it's a parietal layer of the serous membrane. It is anchored to that tough outer fibrous layer. Now, we have a space as we travel deep. That space houses some fluid. What's the purpose of that fluid? Reduce friction, right. And that fluid is called?
Serous
fluid, good. Coming deeper toward the heart, we now encounter our second serous membrane. This one is called our what layer?
Visceral.
And its alternate name?
Epicardium.
Epicardium, good. And what is it anchored to?
The heart.
Heart itself. Yeah, technically heart muscle, you're right. So let's continue deeper. This piece here is thick cardiac muscle tissue. And because it's muscle tissue, we're going to use myocardium as the prefix. So myo, of course, means muscle. This thick muscle layer of tissue is what causes contractions in the heart. Let me come back to this for just a moment. We know that myocardium is muscle tissue, thinking way back to Bio-210. Muscle tissue in the heart's unlike any other muscle tissue. What makes it unique? Yeah, intercalated discs, and you can see some of them on here. Okay, so what is the purpose of an intercalated disc? Let's see, is it a tight junction? Is it a gap junction?
It's a gap.
So that means ions flowing through the cell. It's just like an open doorway that those ions flow right on through. So if we're conducting an action potential or a nerve impulse, nothing's going to stop us as we travel through those intercalated discs. So it's a gap junction. We allow for the even flow of electrolytes or ions through those muscle cells. So that's something that we've got to have because we want the heart to contract in unison. You don't want the heart muscle to contract like the wave in a football stadium. So how does the wave in a football stadium work? You start here, and then eventually it ends over there. So that would give us this wave effect. We don't want that in the heart. We want all the cells to contract when we say contract. So they do it together at once. So it'd be like everybody in the football stadium standing up doing the wave simultaneously, which isn't the wave, right? So that's why we've got to have these intercalated discs. We want the heart muscle tissue to contract together in unison. Okay, so what's another feature of heart muscle tissue that's unique?
Branching,
good. Same issue. We want the muscles to conduct those nerve impulses as efficiently as possible, so we branch and let that nerve impulse travel down those branches. Here's the sad part about muscle tissue. It does not repair itself very well. That means it's pretty much amitotic. Amitotic meaning what? No mitosis, right. So You damage heart muscle tissue, we replace it with scar tissue. And thinking back, what is scar tissue mostly composed of?
Collagen.
Does collagen stretch and contract?
No.
So it is not going to be a great way to replace damaged muscle tissue. You know, there's exciting things going on in research right now. They're actually experimenting with putting stem cells into heart muscle tissue and allowing it to repair that damage that's been replaced by collagen. So maybe in years to come, I don't know if it's during our lifetime or maybe later, but we may actually see people being able to regrow healthy muscle tissue in the heart just with stem cells. That would be fantastic ways to repair damage from, say, a heart attack or maybe just a worn-out flabby heart. So right now, though, we can't repair that heart muscle. It's just, you know, it's going to convert into collagen, which is not going to stretch for us. All right, so let's go back to our picture. And we were talking about those layers. So let's come from the outside one more time. The tough outer covering here is called the fibrous pericardium. It has one of the two serous membranes anchored to it, and that is what layer?
Parietal.
Good. Here's a gap of space between those two serous membrane layers, and that houses a fluid called what?
Serous
fluid. Now we come to our next serous membrane, and this one is called what?
Visceral.
Good. And its alternate name?
Epicardium.
And epicardium is anchored to the
heart.
Myocardium, right. All right, and so thick muscle tissue here. We finally come to the inside of the heart, and this innermost layer is a simple squamous epithelium. The name for it is what?
Endocardium,
right. Okay, so it depends on your perspective. If you're talking about the three main parts of your heart in terms of walls, we have endocardium on the inside, muscular myocardium, and then we have the epicardium. So that's what I'm going to call it, epicardium, when I'm talking about the heart itself, and I'm talking about the walls or layers that make up the heart. But if I've changed my perspective and I'm talking about the coverings around the heart, I'm going to talk about fibrous pericardium, visceral pericardium, and parietal pericardium that make this double-layered serous membrane. So the thing you need to take home from today is visceral pericardium has two names. It's visceral pericardium or it's
epicardium,
right? So that's just the trick there to keep that straight. If you pierced a needle from the superficial to the deep part of the heart, could you track me through the layers? Okay, so if you're doing that, you're going to track through fibrous pericardium, the parietal layer of the serous membrane, the visceral layer of the serous membrane, the myocardium, and the endocardium. Okay, so I don't have to name the epicardium if I'm already calling it the visceral. They're one and the same. I can just pick a name there. How about questions on this? All right, just a couple of other things to look at. In this picture here, you've got a tough outer layer peeled back called letter A, and what are we peeling off the heart in that picture? Parietal pericardium, yeah. And it's anchored to what other layer? Okay, so if I peel back this layer here, it's fibrous pericardium, and I'm bringing with it serous membrane, yeah, the parietal layer. So what I'm looking at here, letter A, yeah, that parietal that's peeled back. And so what I've taken with it is that fibrous pericardium, that tough outer layer. It looks tough, doesn't it? Okay. This, however, is that soft, very thin inner layer of the pericardial sac. And what layer is this?
Visceral.
That's visceral. So it looks like heart tissue. In fact, if I were to try to pluck it off, it'd be very difficult to separate the visceral pericardium from the underlying what?
Muscle itself,
yeah, that muscle tissue. So to repeat, what I've got here in letter A is fibrous pericardium, and I've pulled back and revealed that parietal layer of the serous membrane. Letter B here is going to be our visceral pericardium. That's that innermost of the two serous membranes. And if you look closely, do you see some space between those two? Okay, so what would be in that space? Yeah, that's your serous fluid in there. All right. So I did want to mention the very two bottom terms on page 35. Inflammation of the pericardial sac around the heart is called pericarditis. That can come from smoking. That can come from bacterial infections. That can come from pneumonia, for instance, that comes over and irritates and inflames the outer sac. Now, pericarditis is not exactly the same thing as cardiac tamponade. We would have to see an accumulation of fluids or pus or blood for us to say, now we've got cardiac tamponade. If, however, the inflammation is on the inside of the heart, we have a different name for it. This one's called endocarditis. And so which layer are we inflaming? Inside, yeah, that endocardium, that inside part of the heart. And boy, look at this nasty mess. This is like pus that is accumulated on the heart valves. They too can be affected if you have endocarditis. You've heard of strep throat, right? Okay, so streptococcus can get into your bloodstream and it can travel. And one of the places it can hit are your kidneys. That's bad news. And another place it can hit is your lungs, or sorry, your heart. So it can cause endocarditis if it takes up residence here inside the heart. So dangerous stuff if it's left untreated. All right, that looks like page 35. How about questions on that page? And the hearts in lab don't have fibrous pericardiums. And that means they don't have parietal serous membrane either. I think every one of the hearts we've got is just, it's just this look here. You've just got that visceral layer. All right, so top of page 36, we're going to run through some heart anatomy. I know you've seen some of this in lab. So in this picture, we've cut the heart open, and we're looking at the chambers on the inside. The heart has four chambers in a human body. That's actually not the same in the animal kingdom. Other animals may only have three chambers or even two-chambered hearts. You know, like birds and reptiles and stuff like that. We are pretty, you know, sophisticated, you might say, by having four chambers. We have a way to keep our oxygenated blood separated from our deoxygenated blood. And that is great because it makes the heart work more efficiently. So a four-chambered heart is a rather sophisticated contraption. Now, we have two chambers that sit superiorly and two chambers that sit inferiorly. These two top chambers here, they're called what?
Atrium.
Yeah, good. They're atrium. You've got a right atrium on this side and a left atrium on this side. We've got to keep in mind, we're looking at this in terms of anatomical position. I also want to mention the terminology here. Atrium, I-U-M, is a single chamber. Atria, A-T-R-I-A, is the plural version. So if we're talking about both chambers, atria is the best word to use. If we're talking about the right atrium, we should use the U-M on the ending. Yeah, so just beware, right, for testing and whatnot. So what do you notice about the thickness of the myocardial wall in the atria?
Thin.
Tiny, thin, right? Okay. What does that tell you about their pumping power?
They're not pumping very far.
They're not pumping very far. They are pumping next door, right? So they don't need a lot of thick muscular myocardium because they're only sending the blood down to your two ventricles. These are the two ventricles. They sit inferiorly on the heart. They also are separated by a wall, although you can't see the wall in this view between the two atria. There is one there. So down here, you've got a very muscular interventricular septum, and you can see the muscular myocardium making up the walls of these two ventricles. Now, which ventricle is the bigger of the two?
Left.
And by bigger, I mean it's got more pumping power, and it's got more myocardium in the walls. So you may notice over here on the left side, there is pretty thick myocardium, not so much here on the right ventricle. And that has to do with where we're sending the blood. Where does your right ventricle pump blood to? To the lungs. So we come up through this vessel here. It's called the pulmonary trunk. It splits into pulmonary arteries that travel to your right and left lungs. The left ventricle, however, you'll notice is much more muscular, much thicker walls there, and the blood sneaks right up through here and goes out through this vessel called what?
Aortic arch.
Good. Aorta and aortic arch, and where are we heading?
Everywhere else.
Everywhere else, right. So you've got to have more muscle tissue to give you a more powerful pump behind the blood that's going to your entire body. Okay, so let's go back to your sheet there. Let's hit the atrium and talk about the three vessels that feed blood into the heart. In this picture, you have a vessel coming to the top of the right atrium, a vessel leading up here, it enters into the bottom of the right atrium, and those two are very large veins. They're called vena cava because they're really large veins. So the one on the top should be called which one?
Superior.
Good. And the bottom one?
Inferior.
Good. And what are they bringing blood from?
The rest of the body.
The rest of the body. Yep. So anything below the heart joins the heart blood flow by way of that inferior vena cava or IVC. Above the heart, that includes the arms and the head. That all comes down into the SVC, drains back into the heart. All right. So you know the rule. I got a poem for you. It's February, right? It's the love month. So arteries are red, veins are blue, and the heart, there's an exception of two, and of course, those are pulmonaries. So don't get confused if you're just looking at blue and saying automatically vein, right? That works for the SVC and the IVC. Yep, they're veins. But this one over here that's blue is not a vein. So we just got to keep in mind that if we're using that red for arteries and blue for veins rule, that we apply it correctly here with the heart. Those pulmonaries are actually reversed. Okay, so we're missing a third vessel. It comes in on the back side of the heart. Let me see if I can find you a good one. There we go. There is a vein that runs around the back side of the heart called the coronary sinus. And its job is to pick up blood from the veins that supply the heart muscle tissue with its own blood. That is now our third vein to dump blood into that right atrium. It's going to be true blue, like the vein should be. It's carrying deoxygenated blood back into your right atrium. All right. So to repeat, we have three veins dumping blood into the right atrium. All three carry what type of blood?
Deoxygenated.
Good. The coronary sinus makes me think of these sinuses in my face, but this is just a big vessel. That's all it's telling us. It picks up blood from heart circulation. The SVC and IVC, let's go back and look at those. Those are picking up blood from systemic circulation and bringing it back here to this right atrium. Now, from the right atrium, blood will travel through a valve. What's that valve called?
Tricuspid.
And we're down now into this right ventricle. When the right ventricle contracts, it's going to send blood up through another valve, this one here called?
Pulmonary
semilunar valve. And through this vessel here? Pulmonary trunk. Good. And that splits and takes us to the lungs. We'll come back to that story in just a moment. Let's now go over to the left atrium and pick up its story. This left atrium over here actually receives blood from four total veins. They're called, they're pulmonary and they're oxygenated. Good. So that's one of our exceptions, right? Their veins, normally veins are colored blue on our models. Normally veins carry deoxygenated blood, but this is our exception. There are four pulmonary veins that bring oxygenated blood from the lungs and dump it here in the left atrium. Okay, so from there, the left atrium will squeeze and send blood through this valve known as? Good. Bicuspid valve, you can call it mitral valve. We are now down in this chamber, left ventricle, and when it contracts, blood is pumped up through that valve here.
Semilunar aortic valve.
Yeah, it's a semilunar valve. It's called aortic semilunar, and it guards the base of this large vessel here.
Aorta.
And now where are we heading with blood?
All over the body.
All over the body. This one right here at the base of the aorta is aortic semilunar valve. All right, so to give you perspective here, you know, the heart is about the size of a fist. The aorta is at least the size of your thumb. So that's a pretty sizable vessel. It has to be strong. It's going to carry high-pressured oxygenated blood out into circulation. That is our only link to getting blood to every cell of our body. No pressure, right? That's a big job. Okay, so on your sheet, did you get the answer to the question there, why the left ventricle is larger? It has to pump blood to the whole body.
A lot of pressure.
Got to have thicker myocardium. Yes, so it's got a thicker myocardium wall. We've got to pump blood to the entire body. Okay, so thicker wall has to pump blood to the entire body. We did talk about that septum or wall that divides your heart in half. There is a very visible interventricular septum between your two ventricles. It is a thick piece of myocardium that divides left and right ventricles. But when you go up here to the atria, it's covered. There's a wall in between, but it's covered by these vessels. So if we were to be able to pull them out of the way, you would see there's a dividing wall between the two atria. So that wall actually had a hole before you were born, and it closes up by the time you're born. It should be, you know, on its way to closing during that first year of life. So if you happen to have a hole that persists after birth, that creates problems. We say that's a hole in the heart. Do you know the name of that hole in a fetus? Foramen ovale, right. So after birth, it should only be a remnant of a hole. It should be closed up, and we now call it fossa ovalis, right. So you can sometimes see what looks to be a little thumbprint in there, and that's actually the remnant of that fossa ovalis where the hole used to be. Okay, so that covers page 36. How about questions on that page? That's a pretty good picture for valves, so let's take a look at the valves on page 37. You know, we talked about four is our magic number for blood, right? We carry four oxygen molecules, four heme groups. Well, four is our magic number here, too. There are four chambers, and there are four valves. So let me give you some history on some physics here with the heart. In order for blood to have a one-way path flow through the heart, we have to make sure it doesn't backflow. So we have to create areas of high pressure so that blood will flow from areas of high pressure to low pressure. We do not want blood to drain backwards to its previous location. So we have these valves in the heart that will shut and prevent blood from draining in a backwards flow path. Now, there is never going to be a time when all four heart valves are open. You lose pressure if all your valves are open. But there is actually going to be two split-second times where all four heart valves are closed. It's all about maintaining pressure and keeping that blood flowing through the heart and making sure it doesn't backflow. So let me repeat, there's never a time all four heart valves are open, but there are going to be two times when all four heart valves are closed, and we'll talk about what those two events are called. Let's start with the atrioventricular valves that are found between your atrium and your ventricle. That's a pretty good name, atrioventricular. You can abbreviate them as AV valves because they're found between the atrium and the ventricle. And what are they anchored by?
Chordae tendinae.
And they're anchored to this little muscle down here called?
Papillary
muscles, right. And when the ventricle contracts, guess what that papillary muscle does to those heart valve or heart strings?
Pulls them.
And if you pull on them, what happens to the valve?
They close.
They close, right. So if you pull on the strings, these chordae tendinae, then the heart valve slams shut. And the whole point of shutting is to make sure blood doesn't backflow and that we force it through the next part of the pathway, which is out of the heart. So you'll notice these papillary muscles reaching up in both ventricles. They do anchor those AV valves with those chordae tendinae. Now, the right AV valve is also called the tricuspid valve. Why tricuspid? Three cusps, right? Okay, so there's three components or three pieces of that tricuspid valve on the right. Bicuspid valve on the left has two, and if you keep it straight by saying try before you buy, you're going to go through the tricuspid valve before the blood goes through the bicuspid valve. Okay, try also has an R in it, R for the right side. What's the alternate name for your bicuspid valve?
Mitral
valve. Good. So bicuspid on the left side, mitral valve on the left side. Right side is going to be your tricuspid valve. All right, so when blood is coming in through the SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus, it drains into this right atrium, and this valve is sitting open, so blood can just drain on down into that right ventricle. At the very same time, blood is coming into the left atrium from what four veins? Pulmonary veins. Okay, so let me repeat. When blood comes in from SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus, it drains here under low pressure into your right atrium. That tricuspid valve is sitting open, and blood just drains right on down here and pools in your right ventricle. At the very same time, blood's coming in through your four pulmonary veins into which chamber?
Left
atrium. And is that bicuspid valve currently open?
No.
If it's draining in here?
Yes.
Yeah, bicuspid's open.
Yes.
Drains on down and sits in that left ventricle. So I want to make a visual image that this is happening at the same time. We're pouring blood back into the heart from veins. Pulmonary's over here on the left, SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus on the right. Of course, one set's oxygenated on the left, blood on the right is what?
Deoxygenated.
So blood's draining back into the two atria, it goes through the open AV valves, and it drains right on down and sits in those ventricles. About that time, the atria get a message to contract, so they pump, not very hard, and then they send blood down through those open AV valves, and it collects and pools down there in those two ventricles. Okay? So now let's move our story to the ventricles. Let's talk about the right ventricle. When the right ventricle pumps, it sends blood up through this pulmonary semilunar valve. That pulmonary semilunar valve guards the base of a large artery called what?
Pulmonary trunk.
Pulmonary trunk. Caution, it's blue, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why blue?
That's
right. It's drowning, right? It needs air. So you're going to the lungs, you're going to drop off that CO2, and you're going to pick up oxygen. So in order to go up through this pulmonary semilunar valve, it looks closed right now, we're going to have to force it open. And so the blood pushes against that pulmonary semilunar valve, and it's going to exit up through that pulmonary trunk. Now here's the catch. If we're sitting here in the right ventricle and blood is being forced out of it, what keeps the blood from flowing backwards into the right atrium? Got to close it, right? That tricuspid valve's got to be closed. And when the right ventricle contracts, we pull down on heartstrings right here. And what happens to that right AV valve?
Shuts.
It slams shut. And that prevents us from letting blood escape backwards. We don't want it to go backwards, right? We want to say, hey, blood, your job is to go this way through this pulmonary semilunar valve and out through this pulmonary trunk. So that pulmonary semilunar valve is like a trap door. Do you know how trap doors work? Do they stand wide open? Because there's no trap if it's wide open, right? You're like, well, there's a hole. I could fall through it. Trap doors are always closed. And the only way you open this trap door is by pushing against it. So what does that tell me about the blood pressure to get that door open? Got to be high enough, right? So I've got to have enough push and pressure to force that pulmonary trunk or the pulmonary semilunar valve open to get the blood exiting out the heart through the pulmonary trunk. Okay, so let me go back to the beginning here. Blood comes into the right atrium from three veins. What are they? SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. Blood drains from your right atrium through an open tricuspid valve, and it drains down here into your ventricle. At the very same time, where does your left atrium get blood from?
Pulmonary veins.
Is that blood oxygenated or deoxygenated?
Oxygenated.
Good. It drains from your left atrium through an open valve here called?
Mitral valve.
Mitral valve. And it now sits down here?
Ventricle.
In your left ventricle. Right. So we're draining blood back in simultaneously. Now a message comes along about this time that says to these two atria to contract. So any remaining blood up there is going to be pumped and squeezed down into your two ventricles. Now your ventricles are pretty full. So the message now goes to your ventricles, since they're full of blood, saying for them to contract. When your right ventricle contracts, we send blood up through which valve? Pulmonary semilunar valve. So we force open that pulmonary semilunar valve and we slam shut which one?
Tricuspid.
So we squeeze that papillary muscle that pulls down on those chordate tendineae, and that slams shut our tricuspid valve. What's the point of shutting the tricuspid?
No backflow.
Don't want it going backwards, right? So you want it to come out through the pulmonary trunk and over to the lungs. At the same time, the left ventricle gets a message to contract as the right ventricle. It too is pulling down on those chordae tendineae, slamming shut which valve?
Bicuspid.
And kind of hard to see here, but this valve here, it's going to be forced open. And what valve is that?
Aortic
semilunar valve gets forced open. Blood pressure has to be high enough to push it open as well. And now where does blood go after it goes through that semilunar
valve?
Aorta to the body. Right. You notice the aorta is red. What does that mean?
Oxygenated
blood. And the aorta carries blood away from the body. So what must its function be? What type of vessel? Artery or vein?
Artery.
It's an artery. Good. Okay. So that should take us to the top of the page there. What I'm actually practicing with you is probably what you already know, and that's blood flow through the heart. So if you flip for just a moment over with me to page 38, there's that blood flow. Had this in lab? Yeah, back again, right? Okay, I do want to mention to you that page 38 is a guaranteed essay question. It's a four-pointer. And what you want to feel comfortable with is starting anywhere on that blood flow. I just picked the starting point for us. I picked SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus, and that's where I end. But you want to be comfortable starting at any point because there's no real starting or stopping point. It's a circulation of blood through the heart, the lungs, and back to the body. So we will practice that probably on Tuesday, but I did want to give you Heads up, it's over there on page 38. Got just a couple of minutes left at the very bottom of page 37. Let me talk you through coronary circulation. Okay. Pulmonary arteries take blood to the lungs for oxygenation. That's not necessarily blood to nourish the lungs. Well, that's a different issue. The aorta takes blood where?
All over the body.
All over the body. So we've taken care of everything getting blood except for the heart. So we actually have to borrow some blood from the aorta and give it to the heart, because heart muscle tissue has to have oxygen to make ATP. So we are now talking about, how do you nourish the heart and get it blood so it can continue pumping? And that's what coronary circulation is. This is a way for us to take a little bit of blood away from the aorta, nourishing it through these coronary arteries that are found on the surface of the heart. So when you looked at the heart model in lab, you may have learned the coronary arteries as two little red stumps on either side of your aorta. And of course, they should be connecting to these vessels that lay here on the surface of the heart. When the heart squeezes, it pumps blood up through the aorta, and some of that blood escapes and travels down through those coronary arteries. Now, when people have heart bypass surgery, it is those coronary arteries that become blocked. It's called CABG surgery, by the way. CABG, yeah. Coronary artery bypass grafting. And they'll borrow another vessel from somewhere else and graft it over the blocked vessel. So you can see those coronary arteries should, in fact, be nourishing the heart muscle tissue. But if they're blocked, that muscle tissue dies. Now, we've got coronary arteries. We've also got coronary veins. They're blue in this picture. And they all drain back into this coronary sinus. Where does that coronary sinus take blood? Back into the right atrium. Yep. So ultimately, we've got just a little quick detour here for blood. Blood that nourishes the heart itself is called coronary circulation. We steal a little blood away from the aorta, and we return that deoxygenated blood back to the right atrium through our coronary sinus. All right. So why don't I start by revisiting this on Tuesday? We'll restart with this topic. We'll talk about blood flow through the heart, and then be prepared for EKG discussion on Tuesday as well.